God Is In The Radio gathers 50 pieces from 40 years of writing passionately about music, a former mainstay of NME and Mojo, an author of such acclaimed books as Hotel California and Small Town Talk, Barney Hoskins hymns the artists that have thrilled and moved him most, from Sinatra to Winehouse via the Cocteau Twins and Queens of the Stone Age. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere, I believe, in the UK, Barney Hoskins himself. Barney, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Giles.
Good to have you with us. And those press notes, the Cocteau Twins leapt out to me. I haven't heard the... I had a cassette of the Cocteau Twins in the 80s when I had my goth hair and my felt boots. Absolutely marvellous. Tell me a little bit about yourself and, you know, a mainstay of the NME. I think I had an NME pin badge at one point.
Well, that was where I did my earliest writing, pretty much. From about 81 was the first piece. It was Adam and the Ants live review at the Lyceum. And I wrote for NME probably for like 5 or 6 years, and then went off and started writing books. But NME was where I sort of learnt my trade, Giles.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, in this multimedia, social media age, the kids today won't understand how powerful Music Maker, NME, and Sounds, to a certain extent, were in the music press. I mean, you waited until they came out, and then you grabbed your copy from the newsagent, none of this download stuff or apps, and you went through it, didn't you? I mean, it was like a tome every week.
Yes. I mean, I think it would be very hard for a digital native to understand that that was the only port of call, really. I mean, there were three inkies for music. There was no internet. Obviously, there was some stuff on radio and TV, a little bit in newspapers. But really, the NME was the weekly place that everybody gathered to learn the information, what was coming out, who was cool, who wasn't cool. And the NME obviously developed this very, you know, distinctive, hip, you know, witty, sometimes scathing style that I was only too happy to be part of. But one of the things about this book is that I wanted to include, really it had to be all artists that I really was passionate about when I wrote about them, and I'm still passionate about, I still listen to this day. So even though there are some pieces that I would have enjoyed sticking in there because they were irreverent, it all had to be, the subtitle is Unbridled Enthusiasm. So all the 50 pieces are about artists that I have loved so deeply.
And one of the things is you talk about New Musical Express being, you know, hip and, you know, on the scene, but your book proves that if you like music, you like music. You don't pigeonhole yourself and saying, well, you know, I only like this sort of music and that. I mean, looking at the list, I mean, Queens of the Stone Age, Sinatra, Winehouse, Cocteau Twins. I mean, if that's not a broad church, I don't know what isn't.
I hope it is a broad church, and I don't see any reason why. I mean, I understand the tribal impulses in musical fandom, and I've been guilty of those myself. But I've always tried to stay open-minded, Giles, and I think there's great music in every genre, from, you know, heavy metal to bossa nova. There's extraordinary music made in every genre and subgenre, and I wanted the book really to kind of reflect that. I mean, yeah, you're right. The Cocteau Twins jumps out of that sort of list, and you know, not everybody loves the Cocteau Twins. But I hope I made a real case for them. I found their music extraordinary. I still love listening to it.
I can't still work out a single word personally, but there you go.
No. And that's part of the magic, isn't it? I would love to see a picture of you with your goth hair.
It can be arranged. We'll talk afterwards.
We'll talk afterwards.
The goth thing sort of finished when I came to live in Spain, because you can't be a goth when it's 32 degrees outside in summer. Trust me, especially in the 80s with those felt boots, was never going to work.
No, and the mascara is going to kind of melt down your cheeks.
It was a living nightmare. There's a famous thing that people trot out, you know, which is like writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's entirely subjective. But is there a mother load? Is there a nugget that you hear across the spectrum that you try and get across to the readers?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, every art form needs sort of mediators, needs champions, needs, you know, there's no sort of ultimate authority on anything. But I think that I have been persuaded, or at least educated, and certainly entertained by my favorite music writers, just like my favorite, you know, critics of like art and literature. I think a great like critic per se can only enhance your experience of an art form, you know, and although, yes, I think ultimately, you know, whether you think something, a piece of music is great or not, in the end, it's subjective. You know, you can't force someone to love what you love, but I think you can certainly enhance the experience of people who more or less like the act that you're writing about. So that's the point, I think.
Of course, one of the things about being a music critic or writing about music is, especially in the 80s period, is the fact that you then have the opportunity to listen to all the music coming out, all the influences. So you can, if you're like, and this is a bit highfalutin, so bear with me on this one, Bonnie, but you can like be the gatekeeper and say, if you like that, then have a look at this and have a look at that, because everybody's influenced by everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a place for the gatekeeper, and I hope this book slightly illustrates that, because there are very big names in it. There are interviews and with profiles of, you know, Keith Richards and numerous other big, big stars. But I've snuck a few obscure names in there because I like them as much as I like the Rolling Stones, you know, and you would hope that it's not about, well, if Barney likes this, then, you know, and I like it, then I'm obviously going to like Judy Sill or Eddie Hinton. But it might introduce some people who, you know, who are fans of the obvious, you know, the bigger names in this book. And they might just check out some of the, I mean, you know, people, I could never have been an A&R man, Giles, because my taste has always been sort of not anti-commercial, but just non-commercial. Records that I think should have been huge hits haven't been.
Yeah.
And records that I definitely don't think should have been huge hits have been. So my taste never really aligns with the broader kind of mass of people. And I'm okay with that. And that brings it back to your point. It's all ultimately subjective.
Is it easy? I mean, is it... You mentioned at the start of the interview, you started writing about Adam and the Ants, for example, you know, Kings of the World Frontier. I remember that one really well. And then you talk about interviewing, you know, somebody like Keith Richards. Is it perhaps easier to have more of an affinity with somebody that you start writing about when they are coming up, for example? So, you know, Adam and the Ants, for example, rather than somebody like a Stone who is literally, you know, in marble, untouchable, a rock god, etc.?
I think it's an interesting point, because actually my theory is the music one is most passionate about is the music that you get into before you start writing about it. So, you know, those formative years, my adolescence, hearing Exile on Main Street, or, you know, Brown Sugar was the first single I bought. So the Stones were a real passion for me. But then, you know, you have a different relationship with musicians who are effectively contemporaries. And I think it's a really important point in, you know, whether you write, I guess you do write differently about, I mean, I wrote a lot about like Nick Cave and the Birthday Party when they were coming through. They're not in this book, but I mean, I obviously had a kind of relationship with them that I didn't have with the Rolling Stones. But in the end, I'm afraid it's Keith Richards' greatest riffs that I take to the desert island.
Is it, I mean, also, you talking about, you know, hanging out with, you know, Nick Cave, etc. But again, writing in that period, you know, 80s, you had, artists were more approachable. I mean, I spoke with Alan Jones about this in his book, you know, Can't Stand Up for Falling Down. And you hung with the musicians. I mean, you were there with them on tour backstage. None of this PR stuff, you know, there might have been AR men scuttling back into the office, but it was much more immediate. You had greater access. There weren't so many filters.
Yeah, it was definitely looser. I mean, Alan's a little older than me and had more access, I would say. You know, hence he's got better stories at the end of the day. But I was on that kind of cusp of where it was still quite loose. And as you say, the acts were quite accessible and there weren't the filters. I think by the end of the 80s, that was starting to change. And, you know, the music industry was becoming sort of more corporate and more sort of a little bit more soulless, you know, and the writing changed. Everything changed. At the beginning of the decade, you could write in this quite free, improvised way on the NME. By the 90s, everyone sort of had to write in the same rather formal, boring way, I think. And that, you know, it was almost like the death of rock journalism as we've known it growing up reading the NME. And I don't know where it is now. I think you can still write in a very free way about music, but it tends to be online. It tends to be on blogs. It tends to be on, you know, Pitchfork and things like that. And the music press, as we knew it then, Giles, just doesn't, it's just not the same thing and probably never will be again.
But I mean, this is what I think, because everything now is online and people, you know, we remember when like Yazoo and Soft Cell were coming out and people saying, this is great. People are making these albums in their bedrooms with synthesizers, etc. But now we're in a situation where they still have to go get a record deal. Whereas now people are making, records in their bedrooms, but are sticking it straight on YouTube. So how on earth do you do the filter? And if everybody's writing online, to where do you turn?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the gatekeepers are different gatekeepers, and they tend to be more like your peers on social media and the recommendations. And maybe there just isn't the same requirement or demand for, you know, intelligent critical writing about music. I mean, like you say, you know, people were making records in their bedrooms back in the 80s, but now like Billie Eilish is making, you know, multi-million selling records in her bedrooms, you know, and so there's an immediacy there. You don't have to book, you know, 36, 48 track studios and pay producers vast sums of money, you know. It's a different world, but music's still music, you know, yeah. and you either respond to it or you don't. I really like Billie Eilish, and it's not a different experience for me to listen to Billie Eilish than it was to listen to the Cocteau Twins. You know, I'm still listening to really well-crafted music.
And this is another thing, because I was talking to somebody about somebody of color who likes U2. And they said they'd been pigeonholed because they're supposed to only like R&B or certain sort of rap. And I was like, I like U2. I've seen U2 in concert some ridiculous amount of time. And it's almost an ageist thing, isn't it? Because we're not supposed to we're supposed to be stuck liking Elvis Costello, The Attractions, The Blue Nile, etc. And you can't say that you like Billie Eilish because you're going to look like, you know, Dad's been on the iPod again or whatever.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why I wanted to get in some of the pieces about artists I've really loved from the last 10, 15 years. So, you know, there's people like, I mean, Jack White is a very obvious, like, big name, but yeah. Sufjan Stevens, Joanna Newsom, Grizzly Bear, Burial, Rufus Wainwright, Mary J. Blige, Queens of the Stone Age, you mentioned. I mean, these are all, you know, musicians, acts, bands who've thrilled me as much as the music I grew up with.
And what's the live? Does the live? I mean, I know it's called God is, you know, God is in the radio, but does the live performance matter as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. I mean, God is in the radio, I think, answers probably more to, you know, my early experience of discovering music on a small, tiny, in fact, transistor radio. And that was quite a private experience. I mean, particularly when you're listening to, I mean, initially it was just listening to, you know, the top 40 singles on a Sunday, but then gravitating towards like John Peel and you know, way before the fall, John Peel introducing so many of us to so many interesting, diverse, you know, bands. So the radio and the private experience of listening to music on, you know, a record player, on headphones, I think that it probably means more to me than anything. I've been to many great gigs, but there's something always slightly imperfect about them. You never know quite what you're going to get. I write about one of the greatest shows I ever saw, Chic, at the Hammersmith Odeon in 1979. And that was absolutely like transporting, transcendental. But I mean, if I'm really honest, I'm very demanding and very, I expect greatness from every show I go to, and I very rarely get it. I'm usually a bit disappointed, actually, is the truth. The sound isn't great. The arrangement of this song is a bit weird. The other people are a bit annoying. There's people talking, you know, whereas you can create your own perfect sonic experience, you know, with, at home. So I think there's a difference. It's a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it's a different thing.
We're always taught that, you know, I mean, the thing I always say about radio is it's a very intimate medium. I mean, you know, we're talking now. Luckily, people just aren't seeing my face. They're hearing my voice. Whereas, and I always say sort of TV is like a four-year-old that shouts at your attention in the corner. You have to watch it. But radio, you dip in and out and you listen to it. And when something comes up, you can be doing something and a piece of music comes on and you go, what on earth was that? And then you go back and you listen again. Whereas the internet is a 16-year-old sulking in its bedroom. You're not quite sure what it's up to. So, you know, and that's, and there is a, I mean, we've all had nights with the radio on when it's, you know, Kissing with Rain outside and Tom Robinson Band's come on or something like that. And you've just gone, perfect moment.
Yes. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. There is an intimacy there. And that's something that's very precious about that. I mean, I don't listen to the radio an awful lot these days, you know, but I mean, I do, I suppose my, you know, my primary musical experience, certainly in the last 18 months, has been, you know, just, you know, listening to music at home or on headphones, you know, and I really treasure that. Have I missed gigs? I mean, look, you know, you get old and you don't particularly want to trek halfway across London to see some band in the rain, and it's a disappointing gig, and then you have to come all the way home again. And I mean, I'm just getting a bit, well, you know, I'm going to sound like an old dad when I talk like that, but it's just the truth for me, you know. I have to really sort of believe that a show on, you know, in East London that I'd have to go the whole way across the city to see was really going to be, I'd have to be absolutely obsessed by the artist, I think. So maybe I'm just lazy, you know, but I love music as much as I ever did. And I hope the book also speaks to that experience of, you know, people coming together, that very important experience of sharing music live.
I mean, how did you cut it down to the number of pieces that you did? Because, again, it's 40 years of writing, which makes, you know, which was obviously sends a shiver through the fearful heart, as you call it. I mean, how do you cut it down? I mean, how do you tick out? Because you obviously are writing on a regular basis. There's hundreds out there.
Yeah, I mean, it just simply was about whittling, probably hundreds of pieces down to two. They had to be, in my eyes, well-written, good pieces, but they had to be about artists that I thought were genuinely special. So that was it. I mean, there were a lot of things I had to leave out, but that was what I ended up with. It was one of those things in early lockdown last year, you know, where I wasn't exactly twiddling my thumbs, but I had a moment to think about this. You know, it's a bit of a vanity project. It's a bit presumptuous to put together, you know, your sort of greatest hit. Does anybody care? Probably not. But, you know, there's something quite satisfying about pulling these things together and putting them between two covers.
And of course, when you pull these things together, you can't help but get the vinyl out or dust off the 8-track or whatever way you would listen to it and go back and revisit them all as well.
Well, I mean, I hope very much that's the case. You know, that's really the ultimate point, is that it might make people say, oh, do you know, I'm going to pull out that Al Green album I've listened to for 30 years, you know, or listen to Grizzly Bear. And, you know, I haven't heard Grizzly Bear. So maybe Barney is steering me towards something valuable here. You know, I mean, the point is, I think that I have enjoyed collections of pieces by music writers. I'm thinking of, I mean, Lester Bangs. I'm thinking of Richard Williams, who we had on our podcast at Rock's Back Pages yesterday. What a joy. Ian McDonald's The People's Music. You know, I really enjoy those books. So, you know, hopefully someone will enjoy my one.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, looking at Richard Williams, who I interviewed a couple of weeks ago about his other thing he does, you know, the roasting.
Oh, yeah,
Richard and I go back a bit, but he writes brilliantly about jazz, isn't he? That's his thing.
He does.
As well as motor racing and all that. But he said, you know, writing is the music lover's ideal companion. Take a bow, Barney.
Yeah, well, I mean, thank you. And I mean, Richard was the guy who gave me my first break as a writer, you know, and I am everything. He's a thoroughly wonderful human being.
Yeah.
He's not only one of the great music writers, he's one of the just real kind of stand-up guys, a man of enormous integrity, charm and wit. And, you know, I owe him so much. And it was lovely to see him yesterday. We did our first live recording, done our podcast for, you know, the entire duration of the pandemic. Pretty much everyone has been on Zoom. So it was lovely that he came into our office.
Right. Plug the podcast shamelessly then, Barney, because you're on and people like podcasts. So where can they find you and Richard and a host of others talking about great music?
Yeah, so it's called Rocks Back Pages, and it is the podcast of the website we started 20 years ago, in fact. And it's the online library of music writing and audio interviews, and we've got hundreds of great writers on it, including Richard. And we've been doing podcasts now for about 2.5 years and had lots of really great guests. This was Richard's second time on, and he was absolutely wonderful. But we've had Neil Tennant on, who was also a music writer.
But of course, exactly. Yeah. Was he NME or was he sound?
Well, I would recommend listening to the podcast because he's very funny about how he got into. He wrote for Marvel's comics paper, and the first interview he ever did was with Mark Bolan, and he talked very amusingly about this interview. He was very nervous interviewing Mark, but he became a mainstay at Smash Hit.
That was it.
As he was writing about all these fabulous shiny pop groups, he started to think about what he'd like to do and his own kind of synth pop duo, which obviously became massive. He is such an absolutely charming man, great humility, incredibly bright, funny, lovely man. It was an absolute joy when he came into our... Well, it came into the Rocks Back Pages cupboard, as David Hepworth called it. Actually, say it's not a cupboard anymore. We've just moved into a much nicer, bigger office.
So yeah, but
David Hepworth back.
You've had that. Yes, I guess who I had in my back of my cupboard the other day, that David Hepworth.
Yeah, he comes in and he goes, he was sort of charmingly sort of disdainful of this rather untidy and cramped space we had. But now we've got a bigger and better office. So I'm going to show that off to David Hepworth soon.
Give me this book, however, because we can go off most of it ever, but this book is called God is in the Radio. It's by Barney Hoskins. Barney, if people want to find you again, plug the pod, and where's the website and where can people get hold of you?
Yes, so it's just rocksbackpages.com. I have my own blog, which is just barneyhoskins.com. So that's me online. I will answer any questions to anyone who comes to me.
Wonderful. Well, it's been great to speak to you. Thanks for nipping out of the cupboard for us. This book is called, if you pardon the expression, this book is called God is on the Radio, Unbridled Enthusiasms, but it's by Barney Hoskins. Barney, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks so much for having me on your show, Giles.